The prophecy of Jeremiah, chapter 41, and the first few verses of 42. The last king of the Jews, Zedekiah, imprisoned Jeremiah for advising the people to submit to the Babylonians, since that was God's punishment for their sins. When at last the Babylonians came, they took King Zedekiah prisoner, put his eyes out, and carried him to Babylon. Whereas they released Jeremiah and showed him remarkable favor, as we learned last week, because, of course, they knew, these Babylonians and their commander knew, pagans though they were, they knew that Jeremiah had advised the Jews from God to submit to the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, for their sins. But a Jew of the royal blood was furious at the Babylonians, and doubtless at Jeremiah too, and he appeared in the scene from across the Jordan expressly to murder the man that the Babylonian king had appointed governor of the Jews who were remaining in the land when most of the choicest and the best people had been carried away to Babylon. And Ishmael succeeded in killing Gedaliah, the governor, and did so, as we learned earlier, because that dear, trusting soul, Gedaliah, was a good man. The Babylonians appointed a good man over the people remaining in the land. Dear, trusting soul that he was, he refused to be warned. He was warned that what Ishmael intended to do, and he refused to believe it. It was a most treacherous act on the part of this man with the unpropitious name Ishmael. He came with 10 men to a meal with the governor, and up they got and slew Gedaliah and all that were with him. But of course that, as we have seen this morning, was only the beginning of Ishmael's treachery. You see, when men of long lineage trust in their illustrious past, but their own lives do not match up to it, they still think they should be honored. But handsome is as handsome does. And in our land of 1,000 traditions and pedigrees, long as your arm, a man has to live up to his illustrious past, or he will not be admired and respected. And none in our day knows this better than our royal family. They know that they are on their mettle just as much as other folk. Why not? Surely the Prince of Wales was on shaky ground as far as favor is concerned when he, I thought, perversely went back to that dread ski run where his friend was killed. It was rather unlike the young man, I think, behaving like a willful child. I'm inclined to think that his mother should have invoked the royal we and said to him, "No, sir, you do not go back there." However, this Ishmael, for all his royal blood, was the lowest of the low. It so happened that as many as 80 men from the north, men who were broken-hearted about the sack of Jerusalem, were determined to make a sorrowful pilgrimage to the devastated city. So they shaved off their beards as a sign of mourning, tore their clothes, and cut themselves with knives, which is against the law, to cut themselves with knives, Leviticus 19:28. But they came to Jerusalem with that's the influence of paganism, of course, and came to Jerusalem with grain offerings and incense. And this traitorous fiend, Ishmael, aflame with anger because the illustrious house of David and Solomon had reached its very nadir, its depth, to the very depth of humiliation and disgrace. He hypocritically went out weeping to meet them, unctuously inviting them to come and meet Gedaliah, whom he had murdered the day before. When they arrived, he slew the lot of them, apart from 10, who said they knew where food was to be hidden in a cistern. Don't kill us. We know where there is food, they said. And he didn't. But Ishmael's unprincipled rashness landed him, as it always does in the end, because God is in his heaven, and he has built his universe on righteousness. Unrighteousness can't in the end prevail, ever. And so this unprincipled rascal landed him in a sore pickle. What would Nebuchadnezzar say when he heard what this royal upstart had done to his governor? So he fled. But not alone. He took captive all the Jews he could find remaining who were huddled in Mizpah, because Jerusalem, of course, was no more. And these, of course, included the king's daughters. And he set out with them to cross Jordan to his friend Baalis, the pagan king of the Ammonites. That showed the kind of man he was when this man was his friend. Ah, but when the Jewish army officers scattered throughout the open country heard what Ishmael had done a second time, they rallied forces to go against him. And when their considerable force caught up with the man and the people at the pool of Gibeon, the poor creatures huddled together under this murderous fellow's power were delirious with delight, and they broke away and fled for their lives. They ran for their lives, escaping into the hands of a kindlier leader, Johanan. Ishmael, you see, therefore, was outsmarted, as is always the case with the wicked. And in panic, he fled for his life, and only 8 men went with him. Well, no wonder. Who would go with such a slaughterer as he, but men like him? And of course, where could he go? But across Jordan again to Baalis, the Ammonite king. And we're glad to see that that's the last we read of this exceedingly odious character, Ishmael. But what a complication. Yes, but you see, as is often the case in real life, it was a real situation. A real situation that had not blown up in a day. It had been building up for centuries, this situation. Israel, chosen of God, had come from Egypt in hordes to take possession of Canaan. And under David and Solomon, the nation practically became monarchs of all they surveyed in the Middle East. Thus, of course, naturally, they became a very proud people. And pride, as is its wont, increased with the nation's decline in morals and religion. The worse people get, the more proud they become. I suppose it's some kind of compensation. And since pride goes before a fall, down they went Israel, the northern kingdom, 10 tribes. Then the southern kingdom, as we're reading of now. Down they went progressively, albeit fitfully, for there were some good kings. Down they went progressively for centuries, from 1000 B.C. to 587-86 B.C., more than 400 years down they went, I say, until they were at the mercy of any power that God chose to raise to chastise them for their sins. And there were many. There were the Assyrians who took away the 10 tribes. Now there are the Babylonians. After that would come the Persians, who would lord it over them, you remember. Then the Greeks under Alexander. And last and worst of all, in the time of our Lord, and before it and after it, the Romans. For their sins, God sent, God raised these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, more the Medes, as well as the Persians. God raised these pagan empires specifically to thrash his people, not to destroy them, but to thrash them for their sin. But back to the story. All this perfidy by a royal knave was far too much for this good man Johanan. It was he, of course, who in the first instance warned Gedaliah of Ishmael's wicked intent. And then after the slaughter of the 70 pilgrims, Johanan, having raided Ishmael in his hideout and rescued the hapless souls held by him, gathered them together and led them south as far from the Babylonian power and influence as he could. He thought he was doing a good thing, taking them away from the Babylonians, especially because he feared them. Johanan's reason, of course, for this precipitate step was, of course, lest the Babylonians, hearing of all this slaughter by Ishmael, mistakenly implicated Johanan and his company with the murder of Gedaliah, which would have been monstrous, since Johanan was more than innocent. It was he who discerned Ishmael's plot and warned Gedaliah. But they feared that the Babylonians would think they were all implicated, and so they wanted away from them. And all this time, if you please, there's not a mention of Jeremiah. Not since Gedaliah's death. Where was he? Well, of course, you see, his position was exceedingly difficult. He was really on the Babylonian side against the hopeless stand of the royal house of Judah. And so, naturally, he would have nothing to do with Ishmael's rebellion against Babylon. But what could Jeremiah do? His many predictions from the Lord, and we have them in the bulk of this prophecy of Jeremiah. His predictions had come true. And the main task of the prophet's life, Jeremiah's life, was accomplished. What could he then do but let himself be herded with the other survivors wherever their leader decided his job was done? Sorry job it was, but it was from God. But remember, I'm asking, what could he do? And you're thinking, perhaps, couldn't an illustrious prophet like Jeremiah have done something after addressing the nation for years, warning them? Well, remember, Jeremiah, like Moses, was one of the meekest men on earth. And of course, although such men are the safest to lead a nation in right paths when they have no personal ambitions, or who try to lead a nation in right paths, they are not self-assertive. A man who lives solely for God's will really has no other will. He has no will of his own. And so you could imagine the prophet soliloquizing with himself something like this. Well, they can do what they like with me now. God's will, which was the captivity of his own people for their sins, has been accomplished. My job is done. Like Jeremiah, I could die now. Like Elijah, I could die now. And gladly. But if not yet, then let happen to me what will, I will not complain. I've been imprisoned and in danger of suffocation in a disused cistern. Nothing worse than that could happen to me now, surely. Let them do with me what they will. My job is done. Well, Jeremiah, we don't know what did happen to you eventually way down there in Egypt, where they casted you. But we would say to you, Jeremiah, it's all right, isn't it, to be wise after the event, and we are long after the event. But we are saying to Jeremiah, although we don't know what happened to you eventually when you were carted down to Egypt, you'd better steel yourself for another stand, Jeremiah, because you have one more test to go through. One more test to go through before you vanish off the pages of history. And it happened this way. Gather together as a group of distressed refugees on their way south. It apparently suddenly occurred to them. And they were all involved in this. Two alls, we read in the script. They were all involved with this, that they had better ask the Lord what they should do. Over to you, Jeremiah. Where are you? Over to you. What an extraordinary thing to think of asking the Lord's will now, when Judah had practically no interest in the Lord's will for a long, long time, especially not the leaders of the land. This was something new. Do you realize how new it was for them to ask the Lord's will? They were, like so many who profess to believe in God and even in Jesus Christ, last resort seekers of the Lord's will. When everybody else fails, as a last desperate resort, we'll need to try God. Which is not very good, is it? Or honoring to the Lord. The Lord's people were formed from the beginning of time precisely and specifically to know and do the Lord's will. And the Lord's people, let me say this most emphatically and dogmatically, the Lord's people have no other justifiable existence. You have no business to live as a Christian apart from God's will. They could, of course, if the Lord had not laid his hands on them, have been a people in their own right to do or try to do their own thing, like those who built the Tower of Babel. But you see, that's not open to a people designated to God to be his very own possession. That's not open to us.
It's God's will. Are you... You have no right to live. Although God is merciful and patient and long-suffering, as we were learning from Psalm 106 last night. Now, does anything as dogmatic and forceful as that, does that surprise you? Surely it doesn't surprise you that we are not our own, but are bought with a price, an infinite price, unpayable, but by one? Our circumstances may not be as dire as Jeremiah's were then, and very likely worse later. But neither have we any other justification for being alive as Christians than to do the Lord's will. That's what he has given us, life. Life natural and spiritual and eternal for, nothing else. So this is something which must be bred into us, however long it takes. Well, some of us are still trying to breed this into our souls and into our lives. And it has taken a long, long time, and we've still a long way to go before this is thoroughly bred into us, until it becomes second nature to us to think this way and feel this way and speak this way and act this way. Isn't it astonishing how often and how seriously we forget God and see ourselves as on our own, doing our own thing? My life. My people. My work. And admittedly, when the Lord gives us something to do and expects us to get on with it, the last thing in the world we should be doing is looking over our shoulder and allowing ourselves to be distracted by anyone or anything. Oh, yes. Except the Master. Except the Master. For, as Shakespeare said, we are underlings. Shakespeare makes Cassius say, we are underlings. And should learn to be as happy as underlings. Servants, love slaves if you like, which is a lovely expression. We should learn to be as happy as underlings as God is happy to be Almighty God. It's a matter of facing facts, fundamental facts, and of living in the world of reality, God's world, not the world of the newspapers and the opinions of man and the actions of man. But living in the world of facts and reality. Jeremiah was a realist. Maybe he knew or sensed in his prophetic bones that the day would come when his companions would turn to him for help. But it was a long time. The Lord's servant may have to go on being ignored and slighted many days before people in trouble turn and say, oh, by the way, could you help me here? Folk who have slighted us for 20, 30, 40 years will come back one day plausibly and say, oh, could you help me? And of course, if we can, we will. But what a cheek! And Jeremiah might sarcastically have thought, maybe he wouldn't, we're not as holy as Jeremiah. But we think he might sarcastically have thought, fancy thinking of me. How strange that in your final extremity you should apply to the Lord's servant. What put it into your heads? Fancy thinking of me and of my God. Oh, you poor refugees must be very hard put to it to be reduced to appealing. Appealing as an absolute last resort to your God and Maker to help you? Isn't he just an old cipher? A figurehead? A blockhead? What can he do? Oh, but we really want to know the Lord's will. We are on our way to Egypt, you see. That faraway land which our forefathers were glad to get out of. But since anything would be better than getting into the hands of the Babylonians, that's where they were wrong. Jeremiah could have told them that. We have no alternative. And yet, it's a major undertaking going away south there, into another continent. And we want to know that our instinctive guidance is right. And Johanan might have said to Jeremiah, I am pretty sure you know, Jeremiah, that my guidance is right. But could we have the Lord's opinion? Do you think, Jeremiah, just to be sure, that you could get the Lord to sign on the dotted line? It would be such a help. Oh, well, said gentle Jeremiah, I'll ask the Lord, and you may be sure I will hold nothing back from you. I've long experience in speaking the plain, unvarnished truth. But you don't think we are wrong, Jeremiah, in going to Egypt to escape the Babylonians, do you? To say nothing of getting away from that murderous Ishmael. No answer. But if there had been an answer, it might have sounded like this. Go on, do your own thing. What's the use of me commenting to you or even asking the Lord when people have made up their own mind? Asking advice then is but a vacuous formality, an empty formality. What's the point? So do you see what is happening here? We had a marvelous lesson on taking our own disastrous way on Wednesday at Bible study from George Robertson, speaking from an anguished heart. It was an inspired utterance, and I advise anyone concerned about guidance and the Lord's will, get that cassette and listen to it carefully. George showed most skillfully how Abraham and Sarah and David all took their own way and landed in trouble. Abraham producing the Arabs with Sarah's help. David ending the days of his usefulness as king because his mind had been slipping for long before the crunch came. And setting a pattern with regard to polygamy and promiscuity, which led eventually to the collapse of the whole Israelite nation, north and south. Johanan had made up his mind what he would do, but he wanted the Lord's signature under it. Now, Jeremiah, you are far in with the Lord. Couldn't you get him? Couldn't you get him to tell us what we want to hear?
They had come to the wrong man, the wrong shop. If anyone ever knew, he was an underling, and was glad to be an underling under such a marvelous God as Jehovah is. It was Jeremiah. What the Lord willed was absolutely everything to him, pleasant or painful, and without any strings attached. What's your will, Lord? That is absolute with me and nothing else. And you see, the Lord's will is always the only right way. Whether we go in for it or not, it is the right way. That's what we'll be putting up in the text board tonight. God's way is best. His sovereign and his permissive will, the two dovetailing perfectly together, for he is God. His sovereign and his permissive will govern everything and everyone. There is no other executive in the universe than his. He who thinks he has another will and expects to get away with it is simply an ignorant and rebellious pawn in the Almighty's hand. We either close with the Lord's will willingly and sweetly, or we rebel against it, which only makes more trouble for us. He always knows what is best, because he sees infinitely farther bend than any of us can ever do. And you mightn't believe this, but I hope you do. He actually cares for our welfare more than we do for ourselves, and sees the pitfalls where we cannot. Do you realize how safe God's seemingly painful will is? How safe it is, and to what blessing it leads. You cannot possibly care for yourself and for yours as he can and does. We are underlings, both by creation and redemption. We are doubly underlings. We are so constituted, not only by creation and doubly by the fall, but triply by redemption. He knows best. And we are dependent on him, and must wait on him. His is not merely, I spoke about the best way, and that's what's going up on the board, but we could better that. His way is not merely the best way, it is the only way that leads to eternal life and everlasting blessing. And that's what we're going to be singing about now, in one of the sweetest hymns in this hymn book, 496, 496, a hymn by Gerhard Terstegen. Thou sweet
beloved will of God, my anchor ground, my fortress hill, my spirit's silent, fair abode. In thee I hide me and am still. 4:9-6.